Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
Bellerín, otro defensor, otro disparo. Monreal, gol. Marca el futbolista español. Marca Nacho Monreal. Pim pam pum.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly evening to you, even though it's goodly morning where you are.
So strange. You sound upside down. You're in the upside down.
I am slightly.
Yeah.
I am in the upside down. I'm in Melbourne, in my hotel room in Melbourne. I have to tell you that the Wi-Fi in the hotel room is... Well, it's abysmal. I think you'd get better internet if you got two tin cans and held them together with string. We'd have a better connection if we could stretch it all those thousands of miles across the various oceans. But what I'm doing is I've got like a mobile phone connection, a 4G mobile phone connection, which I'm using on my laptop, and I'm tethering off that. And I'm hoping it holds up for the duration of this podcast. So fingers crossed.
Is this an expensive podcast for you? Is this costing you a lot of money?
No, I got like a local SIM card. I realized that when I got here, if I wanted to use data, it was like $17,000 a megabyte, and every text message costs a bazillion pounds. Mm. So what I did was I got just a local SIM card. I think it cost me $50 or $60 to get, you know, a number and 10 gigabytes of data for the duration of my stay here. So it's not too bad, in fairness, and it is miles better than the Wi-Fi in the hotel. So I am hopeful it might hold up. So
are you having a good
time? So there you are.
Are you having a good time down there? Down under?
Down under, I am. I'm finding it very hard to get used to the time of stuff and what time it is and what time it is everywhere else. I know the people who live here will know what I'm talking about, but it's very strange being awake when everyone that you know more or less is asleep.
Yeah.
You know? Like everyone at home or everyone like in that part of the world is fast asleep and you're awake and it's the middle of the day and you're going, well, this is a little bit strange. And yeah, the travel is a bit difficult. It's a bit grim. But, you know, we got here. We're doing all right. And I am having a good time. Yeah, Melbourne is an amazing city, I have to say, having arrived on... What fucking day did I arrive? Thursday? Something. I think I arrived on Thursday evening here in Melbourne. And you know the way you can get a feel for a place quite quickly when you go to a city? It was... It's great. All it is... It's like Melbourne, as far as I can see, is 75% restaurants.
Right, okay. Nice restaurants?
There's loads of others. I've been to a few really nice ones. I met a cousin of mine last night and we had a nice meal. But like everywhere you look, it's food places. Everywhere. And it's like, oh, I think I'd like to eat there. Uh-oh, no, I better eat there. I better eat there. And if you like food, if you're a food kind of person, then I'd say Melbourne is a city that you would be into. And the first couple of days I was here, the weather was outstanding. It was amazing. It was like 25 degrees. Today's a little different. It was raining earlier. So that, you know, well, what can you do? But the first couple of days, just absolutely superb weather. So everyone said, you must have brought the Irish weather with you. I didn't want to, you know, disappoint them and say that's not the case.
Yeah, just hope they never visit and the spell isn't broken. And what about, yes, have you exactly. done the talk that you were going to do? Was that fun?
Yes, we did that on Saturday evening, and that was really good fun, actually. It was good in front of an audience of mostly Arsenal fans. There was one Tottenham fan there. He wasn't there specifically to see me. He had just bought a You heard it? How the hell did you hear about that?
Somebody asked a question on Twitter. I can't think who it was now. Sorry. But they said, what was it like having a very talkative talkative Tottenham fan in your talk the other day?
Ah, right. Yeah, he did ask a question. He made a comment about Sol Campbell, I think, at one stage, which I, you know, very cleverly threw back in his face, as you would expect. But no, the talk went really well. And then we went and watched the Arsenal-Swansea game with a load of the Melbourne Gooners in a place called the Imperial Hotel. And that was tremendous fun, you know, especially given that we won the game. That was good. But yeah, the talk went well. I was at a university today doing a workshop with some of their sports journalism students, and that was good fun as well. They were quite different from Irish students, I have to say, because I've done a few things at home with Irish students. They're not quite as open, they're not quite as confident or willing to ask questions, but these guys were really great. So that was fun, and just sort of seeing stuff and taking walks by the river. And my hotel is right by the MCG, the Melbourne Cricket Ground, and it seems like a very fun place, Melbourne. It is quite expensive, though. I got a beer tonight. It cost $14 for a beer. It's like, holy shit.
That's a lot. Yeah. How many euros is that?
I don't know. I guess probably 10.
Right. I mean, it sounds a lot. Just $14 sounds a lot. Yeah, that's a lot.
It does sound a lot. Like, one cocktail is like $20.
Wow,
that
like
sounds
$14
a lot,
is like more than £10, £10 for a drink. Wow, it's worse than London. I mean, it is worse than London.
Yeah.
And so, what time was the kickoff in the game when you were watching it in the hotel over your time?
1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow,
1 o'clock in the morning. So we left the event and we went and watched the Tottenham Manchester United game on. Which was on, I think it was kicking off at 12:30, something like that. So that was 10:30 here. So we watched that game and it was pretty awful.
Yeah, not a thriller.
And then Manchester United won. No, not a thriller. And then you've got this thing going on where you go, well, at least Tottenham lost, but then you realise Mourinho's happy and it's like, couldn't they just have drawn and kicked the shit out of each other? That would have been amazing.
I think a 0-0 draw is sort of what the quality of the game deserved, to be honest, and probably what would have made me happier. Somebody rang me up and was like, hey, did you see Spurs lost? And I was like, I can't be as happy about that as I normally am today.
No.
And those Mourinho teams, I mean, it is amazing, isn't it? He is getting results there, and they have bought a lot of players, but they're still... can be absolutely miserable to watch, especially in those big games.
Yeah, absolutely dull as dishwater. But there you go. We shouldn't worry too much about what Mourinho does because we've got enough of our own stuff to worry about, I think, generally speaking. In general, I don't mean like, you know, specifically with what happened against Swansea. But, you know, if you had to start worrying about Jose Mourinho on top of everything else that's going on in the world at the moment, I think you'd be under a lot of pressure in your own brain, right?
I think we can put him to one side for a period. I think that's sensible.
All right. So how's everything in your side of the world? Is it, you know, everything's
just the same?
Okay?
I'm just having accidents and stuff as usual. Nothing's changed. Don't worry.
Oh, no. What now?
Did I talk on here about having a car crash a while ago? Did I talk about that?
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, great.
You did, yeah. Your car was written off, I believe.
Passed away, sadly, yeah. And I bought a new car, believe it or not. Was excited.
A brand new one or just a newish one?
It was only a couple of years old. But I had an extraordinary incident happen with that this weekend where I had driven to my home and basically as I was pulling into sort of one of the car parking spaces at the street, it's sort of on a slight downward hill, and I parked up and my flatmate looked out the window. My flatmate Jack saw me out the window and waved at me because he was excited to see me because I'd been away for a few days. And I thought I'll get out of the car, but on the driver's side of the car was a very fancy car parked next to me, like a sports car. And I thought, I know me, with my luck, I'll open this door. Sorry, I'll open this door and I'll scratch the car. Can't take the risk. Don't want to take that risk. Not fair on the bloke. So I thought I'll climb across and exit on the passenger side. So Jack's waving to me. I'm climbing across, exiting on the passenger side. Suddenly, my foot, as I'm climbing across, catches the handbrake and the car starts rolling away. With me, like, with my head out of the passenger door, like, climbing across, not understanding what's happened, and the car's just rolling, and he's looking, and I could just see his face changing from warm welcome to initial horror to hilarity as my car just rolls about 10 yards down the hill into a tree. Absolutely incredible.
Uh-oh. Oh, my God. Like, arse first into a tree.
Yeah. It went forwards. It was facing down a hill.
Oh, yeah, forwards.
I had to laugh about it because it must have looked so amazing with this man, this big man, sort of man who didn't really fit in this little car, trying to get out it on the wrong side as it just rolled away from him.
Oh no! What kind of car was it? Were you like the guy in that Simpsons episode where he's driving along in the really mini car and Nelson goes ha ha and he gets out and he goes, why are you laughing? This is the only car I can afford. Do you think I should be mocked for having a car that is too small for me? Is it that kind of size car?
Because I use that voice. It's just a little hatchback, but you know, I was just very ungainly. I mean, you know me, Andrew. I'm not the most graceful man, so.
That's not like you, John.
Trying to exit a car head first on the wrong side. Not really my forte. But anyway, I mean, look, this happened on the Saturday. Arsenal went and won a football match. I've done my part again.
Direct correlation. There's just no avoiding it at this point. There's no avoiding it, really, to be perfectly honest. Okay, well, look, I think we should probably talk about the game then. I have to say that when you watch a game at 1 o'clock in the morning and you've been having a few beers since 10:30, by the time the game ends, your analysis is not quite as forensic as it might be. So I'm a bit reliant on you. You were there, I'm sure, to fill me in and to, you know, correct me if I go wrong when I voice some kind of opinion about how we played. But I have to say, the first half was not great.
No.
I noticed that I tweeted something saying, come on, Arsenal, stop being twats. And I think that probably summed up that first half.
I think that's a very apt and fair assessment. I mean, it was a bit reminiscent of the Norwich game. Completely different team, but not an entirely dissimilar pattern of play. I mean, you know, Swansea were quite well organised and had set up to hurt us on the break. They put two strikers out there, really, in Abraham and Ayew, and that gave us more problems than it ought to have done. I think, you know, what it meant was that we couldn't push up an extra defender into midfield as freely, so we didn't have the overload that we sometimes get going forward. And obviously, you know, we conceded what looked like a very sloppy goal, really. I mean, it just sort of, I thought the back line was a bit of a mess on that one, a little bit actually like Norwich's opener in the Carabao Cup game in the way it came about.
Yeah, there seemed to be just like, you know, when we concede goals this season, it seems to be because we've made some kind of a mistake or something hasn't gone quite as well as it should have. And Lauren Koscielny normally coming out to intercept that ball, he would have taken a decent touch and just moved on into midfield. But his touch was a bit off. Then he fell, he slipped, and that allowed Abraham, I think it was, to play the ball through to Klukas. Yeah, so I mean, there was a bit of bad fortune there, but also, you know, it could go down as an Arsenal mistake.
Yeah, I think so. Sam Klukas is one of those footballers who I sort of pretend to know about because I feel like he should. Enough people have paid money for him in his career that he sort of should be a thing, but I don't know his story, I don't know where he comes from, and to be honest, I can barely muster the enthusiasm to invest in him as a character in the. Do you know what I mean?
No, I agree with you. Yeah, I agree. We had a conversation about him before on an Arsecast in the past where we had players who sound like Arsenal players, and Klukas obviously sounded like Lucas, and it just sounds like he's a made-up name on, you know, a pro-evolution kind of game that wants to sound like one of the players that we have.
Klukas. Yeah, he looks like one of those as well.
But yeah, what do... a regenerated player. What did, was there any issue for you with regards to the goalkeeper in terms of the goal? Should Petr Cech have come out, or should he have stayed?
He wasn't particularly quick off his line, and the ball did ultimately go through his legs. I saw a lot of criticism of Cech online after that. I mean, I suppose that my reaction was kind of a little bit unsurprised. I mean, that's not the area where Cech is at his strongest, you know, kind of racing off his line. So I wasn't particularly taken aback by it. I just sort of think that I was a bit more alarmed by kind of the shape of the back five at that point and the slight uncertainty over exactly who should have followed Klukas in. You know, I think like Bellerin kind of let him go, and then Koscielny was out of the game effectively, but Mertesacker didn't quite come across. I just felt like there was a bit of, you know, sometimes with this system, it feels like sometimes we get away with it a bit, and then other times our slight ignorance and naivety positionally can be exposed. And I think the types of goal we're conceding is changing. I think that with a four at the back, we were very vulnerable to big diagonals in behind the wing backs and sort of crosses to the far post. I think like now it feels like we're conceding more goals where passes are played in between the lines of our defence, because I just don't know if everyone knows exactly who they should be following, basically.
I have to say, when I think about it, and I've only just really started to think about it, and I could be completely wrong here, but it strikes me that Petr Cech makes most of his good saves on the left-hand side, you know, as if he were diving to his left. But when he's coming out to that near post, to his right-hand post, he tends to get beaten a bit more easily. I'd love to research that a little bit and see. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, keeper comes out, he puts it between your legs. I don't know what you can really do about that. Maybe you should slide along the ground. I don't know. Don't leave your legs open. But yeah, it was fairly typical, wasn't it? That it was their first shot on goal. It was their first touch inside our penalty area, apparently. And it turns out to be a goal. And regardless of what formation we play, whether it's four at the back, whether it's three and four in midfield or five, whatever way you want to look at it, that weakness appears to be there. I thought it was very interesting, and I wrote about it in the blog today, was Granit Xhaka saying, yeah, the fact that we've come from behind for three games in a week, that shows you that this team has real character. And, you know, you can see that point of view, but, like, how about not going behind? That would also show some character, right? I guess it's not as easy a demonstration of character as shutting the opposition out, but, you know, when you come back from behind, it's a bit more dynamic, a bit more remarkable maybe, but, you know, stop conceding the first goal or stop going behind to these teams, that would be a much better idea.
It's a twofold thing. I mean, we are kind of recapturing that Chesney-era capacity to concede the first chance despite dominating games. I mean, that was kind of his hallmark, wasn't it? And one of the things that was really held up against him and that team, but we're kind of regressing a little bit in that respect. But I also think it's about going forward. It's about, you know, there wasn't necessarily the same kind of urgency. I would say even in the performance against Swansea, even that we saw against Everton, I mean, we went behind against Everton, but I felt like from the very first minute, we kind of stamped our authority on that game and our attacking intent on it in a way that it took us a longer time to do against Swansea, and it was odd. I mean, it was a bit of a, you probably wouldn't have got this over on the other side of the world, but it was a bit of a curious atmosphere in the ground. It was very quiet, and for a team who, you know, had sort of two very encouraging results in a week in terms of the Everton game, and then, all right, maybe not an encouraging result against Norwich, but something a bit heartwarming and something a bit different, a good story at any rate. Yeah,
a real moment.
You didn't sense like a huge anticipation. You know, this was a chance to see Alexis, Ozil and Lacazette all together at home for the first time. And I don't say this to be critical of the fans necessarily, but there wasn't that kind of electric anticipation in the ground. And what we were getting on the pitch didn't really do anything to sort of spark that or act as a catalyst for that either.
Yeah, sure. I was expecting a bit more, I have to say, you know, given the result against Everton, given the fact they also had a week off, you know, between the games, more or less, you know, the Carabao Cup team. And there was that moment, you know, with Nketiah and what he did, and just to sort of reignite some of the feel-good factor, I thought we might be a bit more dynamic in that first half. I mean, do we put that down to us? Is that down to our inconsistencies? Is it down to Everton being a mess at the moment? Is it down to Swansea being well organised, or a combination of all those things?
I think, as usual, it's a combination of all those things. What I would say, though, is that I don't think Swansea are any great shakes. I don't think this is a strong Swansea team particularly. You know, they lost their best player in the summer, and I'm not sure they've adequately replaced him. They have really struggled this season, particularly going forward. And I think after what we had gone through in the past week, I was also expecting Arsenal not to necessarily blow them away, but to dominate this match in a way that we didn't necessarily do. And so I think that we, you know, we have to take the responsibility for that. As a big team, you know, you will come up against teams who are well organised. You will come up against teams who sit deep in a low block. The responsibility is on you to be good enough to beat that. It's not always easy, but I didn't necessarily feel that we had, well, what Arsene Wenger would call the sharpness that you need on occasions like this. That said, this game is pretty unique in Arsenal terms, because Arsene Wenger came out after it and actually spoke in plain terms about his tactical plans. Did you see that? Like, he recognised where Arsenal really could exploit Swansea, and we managed to do that really effectively in the second half. So that was nice to see. You know, I think sometimes he's reticent to talk about those things, but not on this occasion.
Yeah, what did he say? He said they were blocking Bellerin down the right, so we looked to move the ball over to the left-hand side. And that seems fairly obvious. If you're having no joy down the right and there's loads of space on the left-hand side, well, you know, try and attack down there. But I think what you've got to bear in mind is that you've got to have a player out there who's effective. There's no point just lashing it out to the left-hand side if there's nobody out there who can do anything with it. And I think what's interesting about, say, Kolasinac is that he is a player who can make things happen. You know, when you look at the goals that he scored this season, he scored in the Charity Shield, the Community Shield, rather, against Chelsea. That was the equaliser. He scored against Cologne when we were a goal down, another equaliser. He scored against Swansea at the weekend, another equaliser. And while we talk about character and we talk about desire and we talk about all those kind of things, these intangibles, I think there is something, there's a little bit of a pattern there. He is a player who, if not necessarily always going to be a game winner, he's always going to give you the opportunity to get back into a game if you're behind. And I have to say, his finish... for his goal, the ball broke to him. I think it was an Ozil cross, and it broke to him. He put it away really nicely.
If that had been Lucas Podolski in that position, you couldn't have necessarily expected a more emphatic finish than that. And the thing about him is that when the ball rolled across to him, I actually felt pretty confident that he would put it away. And given that he's essentially a defender, left wing back, really, but that's quite remarkable, and it speaks not only to his technical quality, which he showed off later in the game. I don't know if you saw or remember, but there was a fantastic kind of pirouette almost with a little drag back for Alexis that was an amazing piece of skill. And it looks wrong, someone's so big that. Pulling that off. But he has real technical quality, he is decisive, and the greatest asset I think he has is actually composure in the final third. You know, it's so easy. Bear in mind, these wingbacks are sprinting 50 yards sometimes to get on that overlap, get in those positions. It's so easy to just blast it or just knock it across goal or, you know, scuff your cross. He delivers time and time again in those situations. And I think that speaks to his fitness, the fact that he gets there and he's not completely puffed out, but it also speaks to his awareness and just that clarity of thought in those moments. It's a very, very useful tool, as he showed with his assist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to have provided a goal and an assist in one game, you know, he's the guy who ultimately made the difference. A simple finish for Aaron Ramsey inside the box, making a good run. But it comes down to the pass from Kolasinac. And, you know, I don't know, when's the last time a left back or a left wing back for Arsenal got a goal and an assist, which ultimately proved decisive in one game? I think there's really something to him. You know, I know that... I know that it's very difficult to talk about, you know, he's a winner, and he's put something up on his Instagram saying, you know, in football, the only thing is winning. And, you know, it's easy to lash up sound bites and all that kind of stuff. But you get the sense that is kind of his mantra when he goes out to play, that there's only one thing he wants to happen, and that's for Arsenal to win or for
absolutely.
His team to win.
You know, he's classic cult hero, really, straight away. And what's nice about this performance, I suppose, is that there had been a little bit of a dip. And, you know, I think we both suspect that maybe that's had something to do with an ongoing hip problem. And it's a shame that that appears to have reared its head again. I mean, I think this speaks really to the lack of options that we have at wing back. You know, with Nacho Monreal, having been converted essentially to a centre half, and Arsene Wenger seemingly not wanting to move him from there, which I completely understand. You know, I don't know. We haven't really got another left wing back, so we really need him to be fit for City. He would be a huge miss on that occasion.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think he's going to have to do a bit more defending against Manchester City than he's had to do in probably any of the other games that he's played so far for Arsenal, and that's got to be the focus. But, you know, when you do have a player who can get forward and be that decisive in the final third, who can find those passes, who can just maybe even pull a little trick to find space for someone like Alexis, like we saw with that back heel, you know, if City are weak in any area, and they're clearly not a weak team, they're a very, very good team, they're playing amazing football at this moment in time, but if they do have a weakness, it is certainly at the back. And if we had Kolasinac available to try and exploit some of that, I think we'd have a much better chance of getting a result there. So yeah, we'll keep fingers crossed that he is he's going to be fit for that. It would be a shame if we missed
him. Week about, you know, are Alexis and Kolasinac compatible? And I thought this was a game that really showed that they are and can be going forward. I mean, there was some really nice little combination play between the two of them. They didn't necessarily operate in the same space. And the thing about Alexis is, if Alexis doesn't rate a player, you can tell. Like, I've seen Alexis be a little bit reticent to give some guys the ball under pressure, want to go on his own. He likes playing with Kolasinac. There were some really good moments there. So that's a big thing because, you know, barring a big change of heart in January, you know, they're going to be there until the end of the season. That's going to be our first choice pairing. So good that understanding seems to be developing.
Well, look, you know, so ultimately you've got to say a good win. A win that we really needed since we played that Watford game where Troy Deeney cast aspersions on the character of the team. They've won the next four games. Watford haven't won a game. They've lost two games. Did you see that incident with Deeney at the weekend? I only saw like a clip of it. That's something. What the fuck was going on there? Like he was like you could see him trying to gouge the eyes, and he knew he couldn't gouge his eyes, so he gouged his cheeks. But the like the maniacal grin on his face, what was going on there? That was something
kind of
else.
Like an animal, really. I mean, I wonder about Troy Deeney now. You know, when you come out with statements like that about other teams, you set yourself up in a certain way, and you wonder if he almost, that kind of machismo, you know, he has to deliver on that now, because what happened at the weekend seemed completely unnecessary. And I don't know, he lost the plot, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he really did. And hopefully he gets the ban he deserves, because he really does deserve a ban for that kind of behaviour. It was just amazing to see a man, like, I know Joe Allen is not my favourite guy at all, but he, like, Deeney was about twice his body mass. It was just insane what was going on. But I want to just go back, if I can, because we didn't have an Arsecast on Friday because I was travelling over here. So I want to talk to you a little bit about that Carabao Cup game against Norwich. And it was awful. It was like on the night before I was leaving, it was like horrendous. It was like the worst 85 minutes of football I've seen all season, and that, you know, is up there with Arsenal. That we haven't played some good stuff in some games this season. I mean, what about that from Eddie Nketiah, where he comes onto the pitch and his first touch is a goal, and his second goal was an amazing header for a guy, you know, who's not the tallest. Somebody likened the header that he scored to something like Tim Cahill, who is not the biggest guy, but just has this amazing timing, is brilliant in the air.
Yeah,
and what a way to make your home debut.
More credit for it. After all, it was you on social media who said Eddie Nketiah will come on and save us all. I detected maybe a hint of sarcasm in that initial post from you.
Oh, come on, James. James, come on, please. You should know me better than that. No, there was, but it was that kind of a game though, where a kid was going to have to come on and do something remarkable, because it wasn't happening for Giroud, wasn't happening for Walcott, it wasn't really happening for Wilshere, wasn't happening for Iwobi. If it was going to happen, it was going to be somebody from the bench, and Nketiah is, as people have been talking about over the last number of days, essentially a goal machine at every level he's ever played at.
Level, he keeps going up a level and keeps net scoring a hat trick. I mean, yeah, he's someone who I've been excited about, because, you know, you can't help but look at his record in the academy side and feel bowled over by it. I think you know, the word of caution always with Arsenal is look at the people who've come before him. You know, Ben Ikhafobe, we had such high hopes for. Chuba Akpom, you know, both young English strikers who didn't necessarily make that step. You know, there are others from other countries. You know, Arturo Lupoli looked like he was going to be possibly the greatest footballer in the world. Is that fair to say?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, we were all there. We were all on that boat. We were all on that ship.
Tore it up
for
in
sure.
The academy side. It seemed a matter of time till they replaced Omri and Bergkamp, but there you go. I suppose the difference about Nketiah as opposed to Akpom and Afobe is that they never had a moment like this. You know, he as soon as he came into the team, he's had a massive, massive impact. And obviously, that's going to attract attention, create pressure around him. You know, Arsene Wenger has been cautious with him. He said, you know, well, you know, he's not going to involve him in the Premier League straight away. You'll keep, you know, competing for minutes in European competition. And that's absolutely right. But it was just fun, wasn't it? It was just great to see a young academy player come on, make that kind of impact, have the night of his life. And maybe that will be the night of his life, but it was brilliant. And the fans were so behind him. And you could see that in his face, in his performance. Yeah, it was a miserable game, but a really fun 15 minutes or so at the end.
Yeah, I have to say, I fucking loved that header. You know, being a fan of thumping headers as it is, you know, if you've got a 6'4" centre forward, you know, a Chris Sutton or a, you know, one of those guys, Mark Hatley kind of a guy who gets up and plants a header home, that's fine. That's what you're supposed to do. But when you're 5'9" or whatever he is and you're between two fairly gigantic Norwich defenders, and it's all to do with your timing, it's to do with your spring, how you jump, just a fantastic goal. Because the first one, you know, he was there and he had to get a foot on it, but it was a close range tap in, and you know, the right man can be in the right place at the right time. But it was the second goal for me that really made me think, okay, there's something here. And you know, you don't want to go overboard too soon, you don't want to talk up the guy, but it was impossible not to look at it and not feel like, oh, okay, there really could be something here. There's a long way to go, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to be guarded and everything else. But it was a bit more than just like scoring a tap in and getting the winner. There was some real quality in that second goal that is very encouraging.
You know, the quality is there, but the ability to come on and make a difference, the kind of character that is involved in that is a quality you can't really know about from the training ground, that you can't necessarily see in the academy. The quality to cope with that kind of pressure, you know, there's a lot of fans in that stadium, not quite as many as Arsenal claimed, but it was a big stage and Arsenal needed something. And that brings with it a considerable degree of pressure. He thrived under that. He seized upon it. I thought the way he celebrated his goals, I thought, told you a lot about him. You know, there was a kind of attitude, a swagger about that at 18 years old. I think that's encouraging. And you want that in a goal scorer. And, you know, that header was, I mean, what's funny is as they're lining up the corner, I think Theo Walcott takes it. And Nketiah's sort of not really up to much in the box. He's relatively stationary. He's looking around. He doesn't appear to be that interested. And then just as Walcott swings it in, he springs into life. And it's such a great leap. I have to enjoy the irony. The story goes that he was released by Chelsea for being too small. I like the fact that he jumped about 8 foot in the air to nod that home for us. That's sort of one in the eye for them.
Absolutely. Well, look, you know, it's probably going to get him some playing time in the next Carabao Cup game, which I think is against West Ham. Probably not a start, but certainly a go from the bench at some point. And, you know, it's always been a feature of Arsene Wenger that if he feels a player is ready enough, he will include him regardless of his age. We've seen it with Nicolas Anelka, for example, you know, when he was first introduced into the team, Cesc Fabregas. And I'm not saying Nketiah is going to be those guys or as good as that. I'm just saying that we could probably learn a bit from Arsene Wenger about how he views him and whether or not he's going to be somebody who can contribute this season. So yeah, no, very enjoyable though, isn't it? Just, you know, in a game where it was just, you know, for that kid to come on and do that and make that kind of an impact.
Yeah, and you know,
amazing.
What? I mean, I've enjoyed the Europa League. I know that our last outing in it wasn't the most salubrious, but I've enjoyed watching the Europa League games, and this adds another level of intrigue, doesn't it? I mean, Nketiah will be on the bench, I would imagine, for the Red Star game on Thursday. And, you know,
well, you know what, though? There's the other thing, that if we win the game against Red Star on Thursday, I think we qualify. I don't think there's any way we can not top the group if we finish with 12 points. So then you've got two games in the Europa League where it doesn't matter what happens. And you can then maybe go a little younger with your team, or maybe, you know, just rotate a little bit differently and give those guys a bit more playing time. So, you know, if the right result comes about on Thursday, then it could be an opportunity for him to show what he can do in the two other games. You know, one of them will be, I think, away in Cologne. And then there's, I think, Borisov at home. So, you know, let's hope we can do what we need to do on Thursday. And, you know, everyone wants to see more of a kid like that.
I wouldn't imagine anyone who was involved against Swansea or who would be involved against Manchester City will be involved against Red Star. Well, they'll be a completely changed side.
No, complete change again. All right, well, look, we will take a break right here. We're going to come back and answer your questions in part two right after this.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with, thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is the part of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thearsblog. So do you want to start or will I start?
Why don't you start?
Okay, here's one from 49unbeaten2004, who is at 49unbeaten2004. Which is handy. He says, what should the game plan be against Manchester City? Play how we did against Chelsea or keep to the current tactics, i.e. attack? And furthermore, Mike D, who's at MikeUSDK, wants to know, do we keep Per in the starting lineup or is it time for Rob Holding to start?
Well, the game plan, that is very difficult, isn't it? Because Manchester City look brilliant. I mean, they look like as good a team as I've seen in the Premier League for some time.
Going forward, it's
absurd. And I think the maddest thing about it is that they have so many top quality players that they can rotate one or two in or out, and you barely notice the difference. You know, if it's Aguero or it's Gabriel Jesus, if it's Sane or Sterling, or it doesn't matter which silver it is, they've still got so much quality out there. Now bear in mind they'll be using their best team against us, I imagine, whatever that, you know, Pep determines that is. I think it has to be a bit of a maybe we have to go for it. I mean, can we really defend against a team like this? I'm sure other teams have tried it. I don't know if we've got the quality defensively to withstand it, but I just think if we sit back, we might get pulled apart.
Would we be naive, though, to go for it against a team like Manchester City, which is so lethal on the break and which could do you so much damage? You know, that's the other side of that particular question. You know, I think we are, if we have a strong point, it's our attack. if we have a weak point, it's our defense, a bit like Manchester City. But I don't know that we could, you know, if we go there and we like have a go at them the way we've done big teams in the past, and we let in a goal early on and then let in another one, everyone would say, well, what are you doing? You're so naive. Why do you do this every time? Why don't you play a bit like you played at Chelsea? And I, you know, personally, I think that's the way that we should approach it, is to put in the kind of hard-working performance that might negate some of the qualities that City have. I'm not sure that we have the players, particularly through the midfield, who are going to be able to cut off all those supply lines that City can create. But I think if we were to go and go absolutely gung-ho and get our wing-backs going forward and leaving space in behind them, I just think it would be... it would be just really naive, because we know they can hurt us like that. Even if our strength is our attack, I think we have to focus a little bit more on being organized and being disciplined. But, where do you stand on the Mertesacker question? Because, he did look a little bit slow in the game against Swansea. There was a moment towards the end of the first half. I thought he was fouled. It looked to me like a foul. But I think it was a foul that came about because it was a slow kind of a touch. Would you look at a back three of Holding, Monreal and Koscielny perhaps is a bit more able to deal with the dynamism of Manchester City?
Perhaps so. I mean, I should say, first of all, I agree with you on reflection. I think if we can produce a performance like the Chelsea one, then that is the way to go. I actually, in my mind, I think had forgotten that we were capable of something like that, which I think is forgivable given how many times we failed to do that in the past. What's interesting about that performance is that it had very particular personnel. You know, Mesut Ozil didn't play that game. Alexis Sanchez didn't play that game. So do you think that Arsene Wenger... I mean, Mertesacker's one question mark, but do you think there are other areas of the team where he may be ruthless with his selection, or not so much ruthless, but maybe particular with his selection?
Maybe. I mean, the obvious one is Ozil, isn't it? Whether he plays him away from home in one of those big games when pretty much every time he's played him, we haven't got a result. And that's not to put all the blame on Ozil, but it's certainly been an issue that we've had to deal with. I mean, he could demand the kind of performance from Ozil that he got at Everton. Maybe Ozil is, you know, up for it and ready to show that he is capable of playing in these big games. I mean, that must hurt him for people to question, can you play this guy away from home against one of the big teams? Because whatever you might want to think about players, they all want to play in the big games. You know, they all want to play against the best teams, against Liverpool, against United, against Tottenham. They all want to play in those games. So it's got to hurt if you're being left out or being questioned, whether your suitability is being questioned for something like this. So I guess he's going to have to look at his squad and decide whether or not, he is the guy to do that. Can he take on... whoever's playing... Who's playing left back? Who's going to play left back or left... side for Manchester City?
I mean, Fabian Delph had been playing there.
Delph.
I don't know if he did.
So that could be an issue. That could be the thing where you go, if it's someone like Mendy who could maraud forward and cause real problems, okay. If it's someone like Fabian Delph, over whom Ozil could have a real hold in the final third, maybe that then influences your thinking.
Maybe. I mean, Mertesacker, I probably... I would probably stick with him, you know. I know that he had a couple of shaky moments against Swansea, and I think, you know, they looked to test him. They looked to try and drag him out into the channels if they could, and they looked to try and get him one-on-one. But I still think if we are going to play in a more compact way, in a deeper way, in a way where we look to have what we hold first, I think he is a man for that, and he showed that in the FA Cup final. And I think that if he can produce a performance like that, which is a big if, I think he is still the right guy. And I actually think organisation will be a key factor as well on the day. And if you go with Koscielny, Monreal and Holding, you sacrifice a little bit of that leadership. So I think I'd keep him in. I mean, you're a big Mertesacker fan. Would you dispense with him for this game?
I think I would probably keep him, to be honest. My issue really for this one is what we're going to be like in central midfield. And are we going to have the positional and defensive discipline in midfield that we need for a game against Manchester City? You know, with Granit Xhaka and Aaron Ramsey, you know, they've shown they can do it. They did it. They've done it well before. But that would be the main worry for me. It's about whether we need that extra body in midfield or whether we need it at the back. I can't see him changing formation for this one, so I assume he's going to go with the three at the back. If that is the case, I think when you do have a game like this, experience, someone who can read the game, and that's Mertesacker's strengths at this point, could well be crucial. It's whether or not he can cope or the defence can cope with the speed of movement that Manchester City have in that final third. You know, they're pretty pretty amazing, so yeah, we've seen teams struggle against them all season, so it is a worry. Whatever way you look at it, or whatever your fears are, it is a big worry, because they've just been so good.
You have to say, this does feel like a game where if he was fit, you can imagine Danny Welbeck being picked. You know, I don't know who for necessarily, but I just think when you look at City, like Kyle Walker's such a threat for them going forward on the flank. That, you know, he gets in behind time after time, and having attacking players who are prepared to track back and hold their positions effectively could be really valuable if that's the strategy we choose to adopt. The issue with the three at the back system we have at the moment is kind of that in Ozil, Alexis, and sometimes even Aaron Ramsey, we almost have three guys who are granted almost free roles. You know, there's a lot of liberty for them in terms of where they go on the pitch, and we just can't afford that, can we? At the Etihad, I think we'll be,
No, we can't. We can't. I mean, you can play those players if you're sure that they will act to instruction, but you can't give a free roll to three players. You just can't do it. You know, in particular, whatever about the two guys in the front three, in particular Ramsey. Ramsey has to, if he's picked, play as deep as he possibly can, maybe not quite as deep as Granit Xhaka, but certainly not marauding forward all the time, because it's when we lose the ball and those spaces become available in midfield, that's where City will hurt us, because they've got such good players, you know, the two Silvas and Kevin De Bruyne. You know, we really have to work hard on cutting out what they can do. You know, the minute they get into our half, they're capable of splitting a defence open, so it's incumbent on the midfield to make life difficult for them. So that's the decision he's going to have to make. So we'll wait and see.
I was intrigued on the subject of selection for City by this question from @HerbieGooner on Twitter. One man who Wenger doesn't seem to have any issues with playing against City is Alexis Sanchez. He spoke about that post-game the other day. And HerbieGooner says, I see Arsene Wenger isn't concerned about playing Alexis versus City. Has he forgotten about Oxlade-Chamberlain versus the Mug Smashers?
I doubt it, but the difference is, of course, is that Oxlade-Chamberlain joined Liverpool a day later or 2 days later, whereas Sanchez, the earliest he can join is January, and I don't think we're going to let him go in January, as we've said. So I think, you know, as I wrote in the blog today, my highly idealistic head says that City are so good from an attacking point of view. They're just so dynamic. They can score goals. The movement is excellent. They have a range of players they can play. That for Alexis Sanchez to remind City what he can do, he needs to do something, you know, from an Arsenal point of view, in an Arsenal shirt, to say, hey, look, you do actually need me, because it looks right now that they don't. It doesn't look like they need anybody. They're so good. And, you know, that doesn't mean that Pep Guardiola doesn't know the qualities of Alexis Sanchez or would be dismissive of them. So, no, I don't think the two situations are in any way comparable, to be honest. Oxlade-Chamberlain clearly knew he was going to Liverpool when he played against them, and he played like it. He played that way. Whereas Sanchez, even if he does go into Manchester City, the earliest it's going to be is next year. And I would agree with Arsene Wenger, where he talks about players who want to go out on the pitch and they want to win. I don't think it will be something that Alexis thinks about too much. He's not going to not play just because it's Manchester City. I don't believe that for a second. I think he's going to want to go out there. He's going to want to score goals. You know, the idea that he might, take his foot off the pedal and not score a goal. We know every time you watch the guy, every game he's played for us, from the day he's arrived, you can see that he wants to score. He wants to make a contribution. Even if he gets a couple of assists, he's not happy because he hasn't scored. So I don't see it being an issue at all, do you?
I think he will play. I think Ozil there could be a touch of doubt, but I think Alexis will absolutely play and he'll be determined to impress. You're right, City don't look like they need him. He might just want to deliver a reminder of how good he can be.
Yeah. All right. Antoine Eloy or Elois. I'm not quite sure. I apologize, Antoine. It's ACATWizzle, at ACATWizzle on Twitter. He says, after the AGM and the Telegraph article, do you have any real hope for Arsenal under Kroenke's leadership? And we could maybe touch a little bit on the AGM in general.
I don't know if I have any less than I did before. I feel like we didn't necessarily... It's not to criticise the people who wrote up the piece with Stan Kroenke for the Telegraph, but I don't think it won't surprise anyone that it wasn't massively revelatory. It was kind of sentiments that we have heard before, and I think what's more telling is his unwillingness to speak in a public forum at the AGM. I think that I actually wasn't at the AGM this year, but I imagine it must have been a very frustrating experience for anybody who was. I mean, Tim Steelman wrote it up very well for Arsblog News, and that's an account that gives an idea not just of the facts, but I think of kind of the sentiment in the room. It sounds like it was an awkward occasion at best. But yeah, no, I don't have great.
Go on. What did you think of the? Sorry, you don't have great. But I was going to ask what you thought of the Telegraph article.
I mean, to be honest, I don't really think it's worth the paper it's written on or the screens we read it on. Of course, he's going to say what he's going to say. I mean, it's a PR exercise. We approach Alisher Usmanov's statements with a suitable degree of caution, and I think you have to take the same tack with Kroenke, and I think actions will always speak louder than words, and his actions have told us everything we need to know about his ownership of Arsenal, not just his actions at Arsenal, but his actions with his other franchises in the States, they're often the most alarming element of being under Kroenke's ownership, seeing what's happened to other teams who kind of suffered that fate. So no, I felt very gloomy about the whole thing, really, and the AGM, to be honest. I mean, over the past few years, I remember when the AGM, Arsene Wenger would stand up to make a speech and it would always be quite a rousing thing. And he's a fantastic speaker, but the gloom that emanates from these occasions, in a way, I was sort of glad to not be there. What did you make of events?
Yeah, it was weird because I just sort of got down here and it was hard really to get my head around everything that happened. But I obviously read what Tim wrote and I caught some video or maybe at least just audio. I think the chairman did not comport himself particularly well. When he was asked, would Stan Kroenke speak? He said, read the Daily Telegraph and find out what Stan Kroenke speaks. And it was sort of put to me actually in an email from somebody who said, maybe it's worth bearing in mind with regards to Sir Chips Keswick's response. And by no means here am I excusing Sir Chips Keswick at all. I think the way he behaved, the way he spoke to people, was really arrogant. It was like the people were beneath him and not worthy of his time. But somebody said to me, maybe it's worth bearing in mind that, Sir Chips and a number of the Arsenal board were not on board with giving Arsene Wenger a new contract. That if he seemed chippy, if you want to use that expression, maybe it was directed at Kroenke a little bit, But what I thought was the worst thing for me was that Kroenke had an opportunity to say something. He didn't have to say a lot to Arsenal fans. All he had to do was stand up and say, look, I understand why people are unhappy, but I can assure you, that my commitment to Arsenal is 100%. I want to make this team a success. I want this club to win trophies, and I will do whatever it takes to make that happen. I know you probably don't believe me, given everything that's gone before, but, this is my commitment to this football club, is to make it a success and, to bring back the glory days. Something like that. He didn't have to say more than 20 seconds, and he sat there in silence. And that just shows to me that he does not care. He does not care. He does not feel answerable to anybody. He doesn't feel like it's his remit to do anything other than sit and watch the share price increase and the value of the club increase. I thought the piece in the Telegraph you know, it might as well have been written by a PR firm, to be perfectly honest. You get no sense of him. You get no sense of his son. No sense that they really actually care about what happens to Arsenal. And it's hard not to feel gloomy, like you say, about what goes on at these events. Because, you know, leadership at a football club comes from the very top. It should come from the very top. And I thought Wenger, as always, spoke well. But, you know, it's set from the people who own the club. What do they want? What do the people who own Arsenal Football Club want? Do they want it to be a success? Do they want it to win trophies? Do they want to push the boat out to make that happen? Do they want to take risks to make that happen? Do they have ambition for the football club? And I think the answer to all those questions is no.
Yeah, I think that the people at the very top probably only care about on-pitch success to the extent to which they feel it might affect the brand. And that is a horrible sentence to say, but, you know, that is how Arsenal is governed and treated by certain people, is as a brand. And, you know, if that brand would become sufficiently hurt by failing to achieve success on the pitch, then maybe they would do something about it because it would affect their commercial side. But, you know, I think they see it as something that's kind of ticking over and continuing to bring in enormous revenue. It's... And I was disappointed by Sir Chips, really disappointed. I think maybe I sort of, as someone who's had an association with the club for a long time, I think I maybe had expectations of him that he sort of didn't fulfil in terms of the way that he would treat and deal with the fans. But he isn't the problem. He isn't the problem.
No. No,
he might be a symptom.
But that he's allowed behave in that way is a symptom of it, and it's not really becoming of a club that likes to talk about its class and talk about how it likes to do things the right way. And I think what was really good about Tim's article was that, you know, he made that point that there are many great things that the club do. You know, in terms of the work they do with the community, you know, at a local level, it's really really important, and they do so much good stuff. But they let themselves down at board level completely. And it's just like, how can you not worry about where we're going? Like, if there is this split between the board and Kroenke, if there is this split between the board and the manager, you know, the, situations like that, unhealthy relationships like that, very rarely become productive. And they just tend to get worse and have a more negative impact. And maybe, you know, if those board members, and I think we know who some of them are, you know, maybe if they had the right amount of integrity, they could walk away or should walk away rather than, you know, take the money and start doing the PR and the charm exercises. So, yeah, it's a bit hard not to be disheartened about what's going on at that part of the club.
There was another question about the AGM I had. What was it for? Let's have a little look. It was from Sami Azam Ali on Twitter, who said... is the Arsene Wenger's position will be reviewed comment at the AGM genuine, or was it just PR to placate fans?
I saw this question, but I didn't quite understand it. I was going to ask you for the context. What is the context of that?
I think they said, it came out that they said it would be reviewed at the end of the season.
I think we had a question like this at the talk in Melbourne on Saturday night. I think there has to be some clarity, you know, because what can happen surely is we can get to the final year of Arsene Wenger's contract and for it to become a saga again, right? We can't go through that whole thing again. Are you going to sign? Are you not going to sign? Is it going to affect the players? Is it not going to affect the players? What about the players who are here, or the players who you know might want to bring in? Are you going to be here for them in a season's time, or what? So I think there's got to be some clarity. If he does go into the final year of his contract, there needs to be immediate clarity as to what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, is it his final year? Is it not?
Yeah.
Because if we allow it to become a thing like it was before, it'd just be another disaster, you know? So maybe there is something to it. I don't know. Maybe there was some kind of compromise with some of the board members about, you know, let him sign a 2-year deal, but maybe he might move on after 1 year and you save yourself all that hassle. But I don't really see it, because Wenger's always spoken about how he will see out his contract. He'll always honor his contract. And the only way that, you know, his contract wouldn't be fulfilled is if Arsenal fired him. And I can't see that happening either under Kroenke. So it's a difficult one, but it can't be managed the way that it was managed previously, because if it is, it's just going to be another pain in the hole for everybody.
Yeah, for clarity, what Arsene said was that he would sit with the board and assess his performance in the season, and then he said... the page has just jumped. He said, after that, we decide where we go from there, but of course my desire has always been to respect my contracts. So there you go.
Mm.
I mean, the thing is, there would have been... You can see the thinking in the board's mind that even if they were of a mind for Arsenal to go in 20... what will it be next summer? 18? That they could not have necessarily put him under a 1-year contract, because having just seen the damaging effect that the imminent expiration of the manager
would have been crazy,
right, to say, well, let's just carry that state of uncertainty on for another 12 months. Maybe they will reassess. I mean, if Arsene is ever going to break a contract, it's going to be his last one, isn't it? So we shall see.
Mm. We shall see. Okay, here's one from Max Schilling, who asks, Ramsey now has 50 goals for the club, including the winners in 2 FA Cups. Will he be remembered as an Arsenal legend? Will anyone else in the squad?
Really good question, because 50 goals from Arsenal from midfield is a pretty remarkable feat. Bear in mind that in that time, Ramsey's never been a regular penalty taker. I think that the only players who've done that under Arsene Wenger, I saw a stat about this actually, who've done it without being penalty takers, I think might be Pires and Ljungberg, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think Fabregas has done it maybe, but he scored a lot of penalties along the way. And, you know, that puts him in very celebrated company. And those FA Cup final goals are massive, aren't they? I mean, if you step back far enough and look at the last decade at Arsenal, and you're like, well, what are the big moments? Ramsey has been involved in them, hasn't he? And then that 2014 goal, that is probably the moment of the second half of Arsene Wenger's reign in terms of, you know, finally ending that long wait for a trophy. And yet he hasn't quite won the hearts of the Arsenal fans as a whole. And I think it's partly because he's a frustrating player at times. But I also, Alexis Sanchez can be bloody frustrating to watch, but we forgive him it. I do wonder if it's a little bit of a personality thing. I do wonder if that Ramsey's personality maybe just doesn't quite click with the fans in the way that certain others have. I wonder if he's not got the same natural charisma as certain players, and maybe that makes him a bit less of a kind of iconic figure than others who've come before. That's my sort of pet theory at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, given that the first game I remember was the 1979 FA Cup final and Alan Sunderland scored the winner, and to me, you know, remains an Arsenal legend simply for that goal. When you score the winner in 2 FA Cup finals, you know, how else do you cement yourself into the history of a football club? You know, leaving aside the frustration you might have around him, maybe it depends on your age. You know, people who are like super analytical of the game right now might think, okay, Ramsey is frustrating, he's contributed a great deal, but, you know, does that give him legendary status? Perhaps not. You know, it's not like saying he's Thierry Henry or Patrick Vieira or Dennis Bergkamp. But, you know, if you're a kid now watching Arsenal and Aaron Ramsey has given you 2 trophies in the last couple of years, why wouldn't he be a legend? So I think, you know, I think it depends. I think if you score the winner in 2 cup finals, score the winner in a cup final, you're going a long way to going down as somebody who makes a big contribution, because all we want, you know, or all people demand is trophies. Mm-hmm. They want trophies. And it's, you know, if the guy scores the goals that wins you trophies, then is he not giving you exactly what you want? Does that not deserve some kind of legendary status? So for me, you know, I understand why he wrecks people's heads. But, you know, two FA Cup final winners, you know, one in extra time against Hull to mark that comeback, one against Chelsea coming just, what, 30 seconds after they'd equalised. Come on. That's pretty brilliant. Yeah. It is pretty brilliant. Whatever else he does, you can't take those moments away from him. And I think what you have to remember is, how did you feel at those moments? Don't think about how you feel about Ramsey in general. Think about how you felt at those moments when the ball hit the back of the net against Hull, when he poked it home, and when he stooped to make that header against Chelsea. How did you feel at that moment? Is that legendary? I think it probably is.
I think it is too. And I think, you know, legends are built on stories, and I think sometimes we forget Aaron Ramsey's story. You know, a guy who came here as a teenager, was so promising, and who nearly had his career taken away from him by a really terrible tackle, and who's come back to be a top, you know, from that injury has become, nonetheless, one of the top midfielders in Europe, a guy who has won FA Cups for us with his contribution. It's an amazing story. And I think that, you know, sometimes we're looking in such fine detail at, you know, his passing stats or his passing ratio or, you know, from each game, that we don't look at the bigger picture. And I think when we step back, you know, it is something pretty remarkable that he's done in his career, and his contribution to Arsenal is massive. I think the one thing I would say is that I think we might be about to enter a period where he becomes an even more central figure at Arsenal. If you think about the players that could leave next summer, if you think about the issue of the captaincy, which will have to be addressed after Per Mertesacker's retirement, I do wonder if Aaron Ramsey's best days may still be yet to come. But those 2 days he gave us at Wembley really should make him a legend in time. And I think, to be honest, it 20 years down the line, that is what he'll be remembered for.
Yep. Okay, you got one more?
Yeah, I've got one more. Let's have a little look. Oh, yeah, well, we spoke a lot about Kolasinac today. Timo Somelli on Twitter said, "Why is Hector not as productive as Sead? It feels like everyone talks up Hector to be an amazing wing-back, but there's no end product."
It's a good question. Maybe he's a little less supported on that right-hand side than Kolasinac is on the left, because Alexis tends to hang a bit more left and stay a bit more on the left-hand side, whereas Ozil at this moment in time drifts, and he is given the license to move centrally, and I think there's a bit more. I think Bellerin certainly was productive in his first couple of seasons. He got a fair number of assists and goals, so it could just be a little period where we're not quite sure how much he's going to contribute in games. I mean, what is our expectation? Kolasinac has got 3 goals this season. Does Bellerin have a goal this season? I seem to think like he does.
Not in the Premier League, at any rate. They're the only numbers I've got in front of. I mean, what I can tell you is, according to Squawker, Bellerin's created 10 chances for his teammates this season. Only Mesut Ozil, Alexis Sanchez and Granit Xhaka have done that more often, and Xhaka takes set pieces. So, you know, it's not like he's not getting into dangerous areas. I think you make a good point. I think Ozil engages in combination play a little bit less frequently than Alexis on the opposite flank. But I also think that Kolasinac has got a bit more experience in with the wing-back role. I think the timing of his runs is a bit better. And as I say, I just think composure is a big factor. And sometimes you see Bellerin get a goal-scoring opportunity, you see him thrash at it slightly, you see him get to the byline and his pullback doesn't find anybody. I actually think that he gets in very frequently, he just doesn't necessarily make the most of it. But you've got to remember, he's still a young player, still learning a new position.
Yeah, his final ball, if he can figure that out, he would be just as productive, I think, as Kolasinac. And he did score, actually. He scored the third goal in the 3-1 win over Cologne. So, yeah, just give him some time. Give him some time. Okay, final question then for me. This is from Andrew Tegala, who's on Facebook, and he says, "What are your views on replica kits? I'm getting a great deal of stick from colleagues at work from wanting to buy a replica top with a favourite Arsenal player name printed on the back. I've been lucky enough to get tickets for Manchester, I don't know whether it's City or United, the Emirates. I plan to wear it then. I can understand the whole thing with full kit, but when did it become unfashionable to wear a replica kit to the stadium on match day?"
Very good question. I don't know if it's unfashionable.
Is it?
I mean, if you go to the Emirates
all the time. Yeah.
There's plenty of people in Arsenal kits. I think maybe there's a bit of an element of like too cool for school. Some people are like, well, you know, I don't want to kind of engage to that extent. I mean, for me, the cost is the factor. I mean, if I'm not getting that kit for free, I'm probably not getting that kit. Like, it's just a lot of money for an Arsenal shirt these days. And to put a name on the back, you're adding another 15 quid on it. But I think that there's nothing wrong in that at all. My issue is I could never decide who I would have on the back of the shirt because game to game, my opinion on all the players fluctuates. You know, so it'd be hard for me to find one guy. He's my guy for this season. You know, yeah. I'm going to stick his name on the back. So whatever happens, I'll wear that out with pride in public. I think that's the tricky thing.
Yeah,
but yeah. I have no qualms with wearing a replica shirt. I suppose it's more like if we were top of the league, I'd probably be wearing my Arsenal shirt for this season out every single day.
While you're parking your car.
Maybe I'm not. Exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. Attract even more attention to myself.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you wear replica shirts?
No, not really. I mean, the last one I got had Andre Santos on the back of it, so I've kind of given up at this point. So, look, I don't think there's anything wrong with wearing a replica shirt to the game. If you're going to a game, you see it all the time. You see all kinds of names and numbers and all that kind of stuff. Maybe some people would say once you get to a certain age, you know, you're beyond replica shirts. But fuck it. Like, who are we to tell anybody what to wear? Wear what you like, Andrew. That's what I would say. If you want to wear a replica shirt with your favorite player printed on the back, then by all means, you know, go for it. I wonder who his favourite player is, though. That's the thing. Maybe that's an issue as well.
Yeah. He hasn't said. He hasn't said.
He hasn't said.
But yeah, don't let the haters get you down.
Exactly.
Give that sweet money to Puma.
To Puma and Stan Kroenke, you know.
Line his pockets.
Line his pockets. Okay, well, look, we've got a game against Red Star Belgrade on Thursday, so fingers crossed we can do that. And by, hopefully, I will have an Arsecast from Sydney, because I'm going to Sydney on Thursday. With all things going well, I will have an Arsecast on Friday for everybody. But for now, James, we will catch you. Actually, next week is going to be weird for the Arsecast Extra because I don't get back to Dublin until Tuesday. So we might need to leave it until Tuesday. A very jet-lagged Arsecast Extra after the Manchester City game. It won't be on Monday. Just it's not possible because I'm going to be flying from Sydney to Dublin. So we'll hopefully catch up on Tuesday. In the meantime, safe parking. Mind the handbrake. How typical that, you know, you have a little bit of a problem with your handbrake when it comes to your car in Arsenal. Had to be done. All right. Well, look, thank you for listening, everyone. We'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.